are listening to By the Well, a lectionary podcast to help you preach the good news to your communities. I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Robin Whittaker.
This week, we're focusing on Genesis 45, verses 1 to 15, and Matthew 15, verses 10 to 28, with a possible slight foray into Romans.
And helping us again in our conversation is Dr. Meg Warner, tutor in Old Testament at Northern College, Manchester, and author of many books and articles, particularly focusing on Genesis and the Genesis narratives, and most notably a new book, which is partly why we invited her to be part of our conversation at this point in the lectionary, on Joseph, A Story of Resilience. And that's a wonderful book that's kind of church-facing. It's really written for the church to be able to think through this story and help it make sense in their own lives. So welcome, Meg.
Thank you. It's really good to be with you both.
Yeah, it's great to have you back.
Yeah.
So, Meg, we've missed, I think we mentioned this last week, the lectionary does this, we've missed, you know, 90% of Joseph's story. I'm wondering if you can talk us through what episode precedes the passage we have today where Joseph reveals himself to his brothers and seeks reconciliation of some sort. What episode provokes it?
Well, what we've missed on the way through is all the stuff which happens as a consequence of Joseph being betrayed by his brothers. So he goes through a series of adventures or misadventures. He becomes the victim of sexual assault. He is imprisoned and enslaved. And then gradually, he builds his way up until he's the second most important person in all of Egypt, second only to Pharaoh. Once he does that, he starts engaging with his brothers again. It's like he can manage Egypt. He can do that. But then his brothers come along. And he starts doing all sorts of strange things. I think I suggested last week that it's a bit like he's playing chess with them. He seems to be playing with them in a way that's going to create the most angst for them and for their father, Jacob. Now, what's happened immediately before this week's reading is that Judah has made a big speech. It's one of the very longest in Genesis, if not the longest. Mm. And Judah melts something in Joseph. So I've been reading Joseph through the lens of trauma and how all of these events are the result of what Joseph experiences and then what he does as after he was betrayed by his brothers. But here, Judah manages to say something sufficiently generous and gentle and calming that Joseph melts and he decides to reveal his true identity to his brothers. Mm. It's quite an important sort of stage in the cycle of trauma response. Mm.
So when we get into our passage and I think it's verse 4 or 5 of chapter 45, Joseph actually says to his brothers as he reveals himself, "Don't be distressed or angry with yourselves." Would you read that as a genuine turning point in Joseph? Perhaps in response to that speech?
There is an argument that it might be because you can see that he's been weeping and so he really is emotionally affected by this. Later on in the story, which we don't get to see in the lectionary, we see that once Jacob has died, Joseph's brothers again become fearful that Joseph is going to take it out on them once Jacob isn't there to protect them. So my take on it would be is that this is genuine in the moment and it doesn't necessarily last.
Yes, which is so human, right?
Yeah, and I'm interested just in a small textual point here that you may or may not think carries any weight. But, you know, he's had this shift in him, massive catharsis, crying that's so distressing that even though he hides himself away, all of the Egyptians heard it. But he says, "Is my father still alive?" I'm just interested in that "my" and not "our," and I'm just interested in whether that signifies the ambivalence we've talked about in him before. You know, I'm ready to make this shift, but at another level I'm going to reveal that I'm not really.
It's all about me.
Yeah.
Oh, it's still all about him. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm. It is completely all about him.
Mm.
Theologically.
It's a little bit about Benjamin, but mostly about Joseph. Mm.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Theologically here, the narrator tells us or puts it in Joseph's mouth that, part of the rationale, part of the telling of the brothers, don't be distressed, is because God sent me. God had a plan. This was all part of God's plan. I've been sent here so that I can save the people from famine, which is a little bit of big noting because, you know, it's basically implying that without Joseph and the backstory of interpreting the dreams and, you know, preparing the Pharaoh and, you know, more lives would have been lost. But theologically, what do we make sense of the biblical story when it tells us this is all part of God's plan and that plan involves the trafficking of a human life?
And tricking and deceit and deceit all and that's lying gone
and,
before.
And the enslavement of the Egyptians.
Mm. Yes. Mm. Yeah. What do you do with that, Meg? I mean,
the great theodicy question.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there are a number of different ways of approaching that, but it's really important, I think, to notice who's making those kinds of claims. Is it the narrator saying it and telling us? Is it God telling us? Mm. Is it one of the characters telling us?
Mm.
And all the way through Genesis, the things that the characters say have to be taken with a big grain of salt.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is especially so with Joseph.
Mm.
And, yes, he's had this catharsis, but it's still very much part of his character to big note himself and to suggest that somehow God is working through him. So we're back with the ambiguity that we had at the beginning of the story last week, where we were thinking about Joseph's dreams and whether they were genuine, whether they had been sent by God or whether they were Joseph big noting himself and not being emotionally smart enough to hide these dreams from his brothers.
Yes.
Like, you know, you and I might be smart enough to know that if we'd had that dream, we wouldn't rush off and tell them.
Yes, you don't announce that to all the people who are going to be bowing down to you in the dreams. Yeah.
You do not if you have any kind of emotional intelligence at all. But Joseph doesn't.
Yeah.
And so he reverts to himself and he makes all sorts of claims about his own importance and God working through him. And I think that we need to take that as part of Joseph's character rather than reading this as a theological statement which says God made this happen and this is all part of a divinely set up story, which is what then, of course, creates the real theodicy question for us.
Yes. But that's really helpful to distinguish, to remember in these sort of grand narratives that we get here, to be attentive to who's doing the claiming.
Could it be that the editor did that because God is very clearly present in the story of the other patriarchs and yet hasn't been in the Joseph story? And whether the editor does this sort of thing to, I don't know, balance it out or make it consistent or something?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. God is almost absent from the Joseph story.
Yes.
The only time that God's name is mentioned as God is in the mouths of the characters.
Mm. Yeah.
So the narrator never says anything about God. There is a really, really important exception, though. God turns up under the name of the Lord in chapters 39 and 38. So 39 is the one where Joseph gets sexually abused by Mrs. Potiphar.
Yep.
And all the way through that story, the narrator constantly says, the Lord was with Joseph and the Lord blessed Joseph in everything that he did, and Potiphar could see that the Lord was with Joseph. And similarly, in the previous chapter, which is all about Judah, the Lord pops up once or twice there as well. Now, this raises some really important questions about the role of God or the Lord in this whole story. And this is where editing does come into it, because where you've got a discussion of the Lord, this is part of the editing that actually wants to make Judah the winner of this story and not Joseph. Mm. So in the original layer of the story, God isn't really there except really where he is piously mentioned by Joseph.
Mm. Yep, yep. And there is, yeah, I mean, as you pointed out last week, there's a lot of politics and later history behind this in terms of, you know, these are the brothers that become the tribes of Israel and
yes.
And will ultimately represent the north and the south and who gets the largest voice in the tradition.
And the land.
And the land, yes.
Yes.
Yes. I was also interested, it's a little outside our lectionary section. It's in verse 26, but this chapter ends with the brothers going back and saying to Abraham, basically, we found our brother, Joseph is alive. He is even ruler over all the land of Egypt, which struck me as a grand claim because there's Pharaoh who's ruler over all the land.
Bit of hyperbole.
So I wondered if that was almost like a bookend to these lofty, you know, self-elevating dreams that Joseph had, or if you have any thoughts, what's going on there for his grand elevation to ruler over the entire land of Egypt?
It's a bit like Joseph has got his brothers on board with his dreams of grandeur, isn't it?
Yeah, they've believed him. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So they've picked up on his exaggerating.
Mm. Any before we move on to the New Testament readings today, any last thoughts about how you'd preach this or other themes that emerge for you, Fran or Meg?
So for me, the theme of preaching would probably be about reconciliation,
mm-hmm.
And the role of I go on about trauma these days, so I would probably talk about the importance of reconciliation in this. One of the really strange things about trauma is that when you experience it, you tend afterwards to want to recreate it constantly in an attempt to hope that this time it will get fixed mm-hmm. and you can get out of the cycle. And this is a story in which reconciliation leads to the getting out of the trauma cycle and the healing of those trauma experiences. So that would be at the center of what I would preach about this story.
Mm.
Which is a bit more explicit. I was just going to say maybe I would focus on what this crying was. Was it a transformation, a submission to God? We've had a character who struggled with God in every way thus far, and now he has this catharsis. So I think it's similar to what Meg said, actually, using slightly different language. But focus on that.
Using different language. It's the same thing but with different language. Absolutely.
Yep. Wonderful. Let's move on. Do you want to say anything about Romans briefly, Fran?
Oh, well, not just yet. Okay. No, it was all just right. Whether there were echoes once we get a bit into Matthew, but okay. I'm not promising anything.
Let's go to Matthew 15 then. And you have a choice in the lectionary here. There's a bracketed section, 10 to 20, and then if you want a smaller focus, verses 21 to 28, which is the story of the Canaanite woman, which you might also recognize as the story of the Syrophoenician woman, as she's called in Mark 7. So again, Matthew is picking up a Markan story here. And in doing so, he picks up the Markan context too, which is those first verses, 10 to 20, are all part of Jesus' teaching about cleanliness and purity mm-hmm. and that it's not what goes in that makes you clean or unclean, but what comes out. So we've got some framing here that I think is going to be really important for then focusing on the dynamics of this difficult, I want to name. You might want to run screaming from this passage if you're a preacher. This is a difficult and demanding story of Jesus' interaction with this woman.
I was just going to say, if you were going to sort of spend any time on those 10 to 20, those verses, just be really careful about what Jesus is saying about the law and what he's not saying.
Yes.
Just in terms of accuracy, he was a Jew. He wasn't rejecting everything that he believed and, you know, lived by. But I think what's happening here is a Matthean emphasis on mercy and justice and love being that which is the main criterion for interpreting law.
That's helpful because there's places in Matthew where Jesus will actually make the law harsher than it is in the Torah. And there's places like here where he appears to be sort of opening it up and wanting to move away from a more technical, I guess.
Or legalistic or something, yeah.
But
the whole tension in chapter 5 where it says not a jot or tittle will pass from the law, and then he seems to go and just change the whole law.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think just for a community, a congregation, yeah, it's really important to say what isn't happening here.
Yes, and to not do what we've done too easily in the tradition and make Jesus the exception to the Judaism of his day as he's engaging in that dialogue. What else do we, I mean, I don't know where to begin in this story.
Well, I think I'd say that, so we've had this conversation here about purity and so on. What we see when we get to the Canaanite woman is kind of a geographical playing out of what Jesus has just been talking about.
Yes.
In terms of where he's going and who he encounters.
Yeah, we're at the borders. So he's crossing several boundaries, for want of a better word. So geographically, there's a gender disparity here. It's a man talking to a woman. They're of different religious backgrounds, different, well, maybe not that different, but the fact that she's called a Canaanite is a way of othering her from Jesus. And again, a label of othering that goes all the way back to the Hebrew Bible in the distinction, the identity of making yourself an Israelite as opposed to a Canaanite.
She does actually use the Jewish title when she talks to him, though.
Which one's that?
Well, when she says who he is, she talks to him. Where is it?
Lord and Master, or just Master?
Lord, help me, she says.
Yeah, Lord, no, she says in verse 21, Lord, son of David.
Oh, yes, she does, yes. She recognises him as a Jewish son, yes, in that tradition. Yep, good point. And the cleanliness here, I think, is important because both her and her daughter are unclean, according to Jewish law, partly because she's a Gentile or and then the daughter because she's got this unclean spirit, or Mark calls her an unclean spirit, Matthew calls her a demon.
Demon possessed.
But either way, rendered unclean. Mm. So we've got two women, an invisible daughter, but who are doubly sort of unclean and othered. And then this really difficult, you know, the way Jesus talks to her, people have tried to rescue this. Mm. In my opinion, we cannot rescue the ethnic slur in Jesus' words of calling her a dog. Like, you know, he is reflecting the cultural assumptions of his day. That he is somehow superior to her and she does not deserve the same status in the kingdom.
Yep.
Yep.
I think what's interesting for us to think about is that we're dogs in this passage.
As Protestants or whoever we are.
Well, as Christians. Yes. I mean, non-Jewish Christians. Yeah. I mean, I think this has been sort of popularly interpreted as, you know, we liberal-minded people are horrified at his treatment of her and she puts him in his place kind of thing is the common reading of this, which I think's a bit slick because what's happening here, she actually doesn't disagree with him. So she says, well, yes, it's true. I'm not of Israel. And yet,
even the dogs. Yeah.
And so I think what's being rammed home here by Matthew is the source of the blessing, which is Israel. And it's through Israel that all are embraced. It's not that we hold it ourselves.
Yeah, I think we might be at a point in Matthew's gospel here where, and this is one classic way to interpret this passage, where the mission of Jesus is starting to be opened up. So we've gone from in chapter 10, there's been that classic verse about, you know, I came to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. By the time we get to the end of the gospel, it's make disciples of all nations. So there is a movement.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the other thing to parallel this with the previous story from last week, so not immediately previous in the text but previous in the lectionary, is the response to the disciples freaking out really about Jesus walking on water is that Jesus calls them like of little faith, you of little faith. And here this woman is told you have great faith. Yeah. So we've got an interesting contrast in the text between a Gentile woman who is doubly unclean but has great faith and these Jewish male disciples who have little faith despite spending all this time with Jesus.
So here's another Jewish aspect of the story going on. I would pick up what you were suggesting, Robin, and go one step further and say that we've got a turning point in this story which matches quite closely the turning point that we were just talking about in the Joseph story. Because here Jesus, it's as if Jesus suddenly understands the shape of his mission for the first time and appreciates its Gentile bits or parts or reach in a way that he hadn't done before. And this has only just occurred to me, but it's like the fact that he calls the woman a dog helps us to make a really big contrast between what Jesus understands at the beginning of the story and what Jesus understands at the rest of the story, and then which gets worked out through the rest of the gospel, exactly as you're suggesting. And this is typical of a Jewish story to exaggerate how bad something is at the beginning so that when it changes, the change is dramatic.
And you can't miss it.
And you can't miss it.
Yeah.
So I think I'm wondering for preaching purposes whether the point's actually not an opposite one, but you're highlighting a different aspect of this, which is remember, folks, we're only here as the church because of Israel. The blessing has come from Israel. It's not something we've owned or created ourselves. I've been reading a book about race and Christian and theology by Willie Jenkins, and he makes this really powerful point that supersessionism, which is when basically we see the church replacing Israel, is what has created what he calls white Christianity, which is just this essentially arrogant assumption that that this is normative. That we hold this thing that we then take out to everyone else when, in fact, we are receivers.
Yes.
From Israel. We are receivers of this gift that we share, not that we've got this thing we own that we've sort of somehow made ours.
And that we, as you said before, we've been brought into it as the Gentiles by grace, as Paul would put it, not because we were the original chosen people of God, which is Israel.
So you see what I mean? Like the emphasis perhaps for our communities is to understand our Israelite origins, if you like, whereas the point of the story is to say this mission is as wide as the world. We know the mission's as wide as the world, but where's it from?
Yep.
And what does that mean for how we understand our brothers and sisters of Judaism?
Yes. And I think there's a related angle you could take here. The world seems to be having a conversation again, but an important one, about race and racism, and there's sort of a heightened awareness of you know, that one can't just be neutral in this space, and so the language of anti-racist has sort of come into, I think, for the first time for a lot of white people, if I'm honest. But there is a sense here that Jesus is being racist, and I say that to unpack, because we have to be so careful what we mean by that, because if we reduce racism to one individual being deliberately mean or oppressive to another individual, it can be classified as sin, and then we get into all sorts of problems here. But Jesus is being racist in the sense that he is reflecting the cultural values of his time and place, perhaps unthinkingly, perhaps deliberately. You know,
perhaps deliberately with hyperbole, actually.
Yes,
maybe.
Exactly. Like, we can only hypothesize about that, and people have. But I think the learning point for us is less to focus on did Jesus mean it, and you know, and to say, well, how do we do this? How do we unreflectively repeat those negative cultural assumptions about other people and therefore make them outsiders? That's the individual question. I guess the larger systemic question is how do we do that as a society and particularly as a church? Who do we make outsiders? Or do we feel like the outsiders and who do we think we're looking in on? And there's all sorts of stuff to play with there in terms of current conversations.
Another way of going is actually to ask what it is her faith is.
Yes, because she doesn't become a Jesus follower.
No. I mean, it appears to be faith that this bread is enough, even the crumbs, which goes back to the feeding of the 5,000. I just think there's an enormous amount there too, looking at what it is, you know, great is her faith. Well, what is it? Because has her daughter been healed? I can't remember.
Well, she does. She does eventually. She's told she's healed, but doesn't necessarily know that at that point.
And the gospel opens with these five women in the genealogy in the first chapter, and all of them are sexually suspect for some reason, and they're pretty much all foreigners. And yet they're there to be models for who Mary is. Mm. And so here is another unexpected woman who is othered in four or five different ways. And yet she becomes the person who speaks truth to Jesus and who helps him to see his mission and his identity in a different way.
Yeah.
And so what Matthew has to say in terms of ethnicity is about as profound as it comes.
Yeah, I think so. And I think to ignore that aspect of this story in our current context is, you know, not to take it seriously for how radical. And it astonishes me in some ways this story is here, because it would have been the easiest thing in the world for Matthew, writing to a predominantly Jewish audience from what we know,
to leave it out,
to have just left out this bit of the story. Doesn't necessarily make Jesus look great, but it's in there along with those subversive women because it's doing some really important theological work.
Well, he accentuates it. He says more than Matthew does. Matthew doesn't have any Jesus saying anything about I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel.
Yeah.
But Matthew says it. So Matthew's actually building on it and making it more significant.
Yeah. And perhaps because of that hyperbole to who he's speaking to, he has to kind of drum this home. Where did you see links to Romans, Fran?
I'm just looking here. It's Israel's rejection is not final. So it's about, again, the source of the blessing and the disobedience and then the obedience of the one who brings everyone back. So it's about, I mean, very generally speaking, the universalism of the gospel, which is what this is saying as well. But the particularity of Israel that enables it.
Well, thank you, Dr. Meg Warner, for being with us this week and for last week's episode too.
Yeah, thank you for the insights and the contributions. And
It's been great to have a conversation with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll put a link in the show notes and on our Facebook page to Meg's book, Joseph, A Story of Resilience, a wonderful resource for churches and Christian communities everywhere.
You've been listening to By the Well, a podcast brought to you by the Uniting Church in Australia and Pilgrim Theological College. Thanks for listening.